Oppenheimer was often incredibly naive. On the organization chart he gave Manley, he had listed himself as both director of the lab and chief of the theoretical division. But it soon became clear to his colleagues, and finally to Robert, that he hadn't the time to do both jobs, so he appointed Hans Bethe to head the theoretical division. He also told General Groves that he thought he would need only a handful of scientists. Major Dudley claims that when they were first scouting the site, Oppenheimer remarked that he thought six scientists, joined by a number of engineers and technicians, could do the job. While this is probably an exaggeration, the point is clear. Oppenheimer at first greatly underestimated the magnitude of the job. The initial construction contract budgeted $300,000, but within a year, $7.5 million had been spent. When Los Alamos opened in March 1943, 100 scientists, engineers, and support staff converged on the new community. Within 6 months, there were 1,000, and a year later, there were 3,500 people living on the mesa. By the summer of 1945, Oppenheimer's wilderness outpost had grown into a small town of at least 4,000 civilians and 2,000 men in uniform. They lived in 300 apartment buildings, 52 dormitories, and some 200 trailers. The technical area alone enclosed 37 buildings, including a plutonium purification plant, a foundry, a library, an auditorium, and dozens of laboratories, warehouses, and offices. To the dismay of nearly all his colleagues, Oppenheimer had originally accepted General Groves' suggestion that all the scientists in the new lab should become commissioned Army officers. In mid-January 1943, Oppenheimer visited the Presidio, an army base in San Francisco, to arrange for his commission as a lieutenant colonel. He actually took the army physical and failed it. Army doctors reported that at 128 pounds, Oppenheimer was 11 pounds under the minimum weight and 27 pounds under the ideal weight for a man his age and height. They noted he had a chronic cough, dating back to 1927, when x-rays of his chest had confirmed a case of tuberculosis. He also reported a history of lumbosacral strain. Every 10 days or so, he said, he felt moderate pains shooting down his left leg. For all these reasons, the Army doctors deemed him permanently incapacitated for active service. But because Groves had already instructed the doctors that Oppenheimer had to be cleared for duty, he was asked to sign a note acknowledging the existence of the above physical defects and requesting that he nevertheless be placed on extended active duty. After the physical, Oppenheimer had an officer's uniform tailored for him. His motivations were complex. Perhaps donning a colonel's uniform was a visible sign of acceptance important to a man who was self-conscious about his Jewish heritage. But wearing a uniform was also the patriotic thing to do in 1942. Across the country, men and women were donning military uniforms in a symbolic, primordial ritual of defending the tribe, the country, and the uniform was a visible statement of this commitment. There was a lot of apple pie in Robert's psyche. "Oppie would get a faraway look in his eyes," recalled Robert Wilson, "and tell me that this war was different from any war ever fought before. It was a war about the principles of freedom." He was convinced that the war effort was a mass effort to overthrow the Nazis and upset fascism, and he talked of a people's army and a people's war. The language had changed so little. It's the same kind of political language, except that now it has a patriotic flavor, whereas before it had just a radical flavor. Soon after Oppenheimer began making his rounds to recruit physicists to Los Alamos, however, he discovered that his peers flatly opposed the notion of having to work under military discipline. By February 1943, his old friend Isidore Rabi and several other physicists had persuaded him that the laboratory must demilitarize. Rabi was one of the few among Oppie's friends who could tell him when he was being foolish. "He thought it would be fine to go in uniform because we were at war. It would bring us closer to the American people, that sort of crap. I know he wanted seriously to win the war, but we couldn't make a bomb that way." In addition to being very wise, he was very foolish. By the end of that month, Groves agreed to a compromise. During the lab's experimental work, the scientists would remain civilians. But when the time came to test the weapon, everyone would don a uniform. Los Alamos would be fenced and designated an army post. But within the technical area of the lab itself, the scientist would report to Oppenheimer as scientific director. The army would control access to the community, but it would not control the exchange of information among the scientists. That was Oppenheimer's responsibility. Hans Bethe congratulated Oppie on his negotiations with the army, writing him that, "I think that you have now earned a degree in high diplomacy." Robbie played a critical role in this and other organizational issues. "Without Robbie," Bethe later said, "it would have been a mess because Oppie did not want to have an organization. Robbie and Lee DeBridge, then head of MIT's radiation laboratory, came to Oppie and said, 'You have to have an organization. The laboratory has to be organized in divisions and the divisions into groups. Otherwise, nothing will ever come of it.' And Oppie, well, that was all new to him." Robbie made Oppie more practical. He talked Oppie out of putting on a uniform. One of Oppenheimer's great disappointments was his failure to persuade Isidore Robbie to relocate to Los Alamos. He so wanted Robbie aboard that he offered him the associate directorship of the laboratory, but to no avail. Robbie had fundamental doubts about the whole notion of building a bomb. "I was strongly opposed to bombing ever since 1931, when I saw those pictures of the Japanese bombing that suburb of Shanghai. You drop a bomb and it falls on the just and the unjust. There is no escape from it. The prudent man can't escape, nor the honest man. During the war with Germany, we, in the Rad Lab, certainly helped to develop devices for bombing, but this was a real enemy and a serious matter. But atomic bombing just carried the principle one step further, and I didn't like it then, and I don't now. I think it's terrible." To Robbie's way of thinking, this war would be won with a far less exotic technology: radar. "I thought it over," Robbie recalled, "and turned him down. I said, 'I'm very serious about this war. We could lose it with insufficient radar.'" Robbie also gave a less practical but more profound reason for not joining. He did not, he told Oppenheimer, wish to make the culmination of 3 centuries of physics a weapon of mass destruction. This was an extraordinary statement, one that Robbie knew might well resonate with a man of Oppenheimer's philosophical bent. But if Robbie was already thinking about the moral consequences of an atomic bomb, Oppenheimer, in the midst of this war, for once had no patience for the metaphysical. He now brushed aside his friend's objection. "I think if I believe with you that this project was the culmination of 3 centuries of physics," he wrote Robbie, "I should take a different stand. To me, it is primarily the development in time of a war of a military weapon of some consequence. I do not think that the Nazis allow us the option of not carrying out that development." Only one thing mattered now to Oppenheimer: building the weapon before the Nazis did. If Robbie refused to move to Los Alamos, Oppenheimer nevertheless prevailed upon him to come to the first colloquium and thereafter to serve as one of the project's rare visiting consultants. Robbie became, as Hans Bethe put it, the fatherly advisor to Oppie. "I never went on the payroll at Los Alamos," Robbie said. "I refused to. I wanted to have my lines of communication clear. I was not a member of any of their important committees or anything of the sort, but just Oppenheimer's advisor." Moreover, Robbie was instrumental in persuading both Hans Bethe and many others to move to Los Alamos. He also urged Oppenheimer to appoint Bethe as chief of the theoretical division, which he called the nerve center of the project. Oppenheimer trusted Robbie's judgments in all these matters and acted quickly upon his suggestions. When Robbie warned him that morale is sinking among the group of physicists working in Princeton, Oppenheimer decided to import the entire Princeton team of 20 scientists to Los Alamos. This turned out to be a particularly serendipitous decision, as the Princeton group included not only Robert Wilson, but a brilliant and cheerfully mischievous 24-year-old physicist named Richard Feynman. Oppenheimer had immediately recognized the genius in Feynman and knew he wanted him at Los Alamos. However, Feynman's wife, Arlene, was battling tuberculosis, and Feynman made it clear he could not move to Los Alamos without her. Feynman thought that had ended the matter, but one day in the winter of early 1943, he received a long-distance phone call from Chicago. It was Oppenheimer, calling to say that he had located a tuberculosis sanatorium for Arlene in Albuquerque. Feynman, he assured him, could work in Los Alamos and visit Arlene on the weekends. Feynman was touched and persuaded. Oppenheimer was relentless in his pursuit of men to work on the Mesa, the Hill, as it was soon nicknamed. He had begun in the autumn of 1942, even before Los Alamos had been selected as Site Y. "We should start now," he wrote Manley, "on a policy of absolutely unscrupulous recruiting of anyone we can lay hands on." Among his early targets was Robert Baker, an MIT administrator and experimental physicist. Only after months of persistent lobbying did Baker finally agree to move to Los Alamos in June 1943 and direct the project's Division of Experimental Physics. Oppenheimer wrote Baker earlier that spring that his qualifications made him very nearly unique, and that is why I have pursued you with such diligence for so many months. "He believed strongly," Oppenheimer wrote him, "in your stability and judgment, qualities on which this stormy enterprise puts a very high premium."
Baker came, but warned that he would resign if he were ever asked to put on an army uniform.